Senator Nunn, thanks for having us again in your office, and welcome back to Morning Edition.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Great to be with you.
The idea of the low-enriched uranium bank is pretty simple. The idea is to prevent nuclear proliferation by giving states access to the fuels that they might need in a crisis. But how this happens is so very technical. Can you boil it down into terms the rest of us can understand?
Well, let's try it this way. Nuclear power is not growing in the United States, but it is growing in a lot of parts of the world, and some countries have no alternative but nuclear power. As countries desire civil nuclear power, the idea here is to make sure they know that they do not have to start their own enrichment process. Enrichment is basically taking natural uranium and basically going through a process which is expensive and also could be enormously dangerous, because the thing to keep in mind is the same technology, the same procedures used to enrich to a low level for legitimate civil power purposes and medical purposes and others. But that's the same type of technology that goes to a high level, and if taken to a high level, can make a bomb. Hiroshima or Nagasaki, or think of it in terms of a crude weapon or whatever you would like. But that technology has dual purpose. So the idea here is to encourage nations to rely on the marketplace with this internationally controlled fuel supply as a backup. So it may never be used, but psychologically, if countries know that there is a backup and they know that the marketplace generally works and they're not going to be discriminated against as long as they are in compliance with their non-proliferation treaty safeguard obligations, making sure they don't convert peaceful to malignant type use of nuclear weapons. So the idea is a backup insurance policy.
What's the incentive for them to take part? I mean, what can they get from this that they wouldn't be able to get by just developing their own low-enriched or possibly bomb-grade uranium supplies on their own?
Well, first of all, when you develop an enrichment process, your neighbors are going to take notice, and it will frighten the whole area, as we see in North Korea, as we see in Iran. Those are two countries that are an example of what we don't want to happen in the future. So you make your neighbors nervous. The second thing is you got to explain to your own people if the marketplace is working and if there's this backup fuel supply internationally controlled, why you're spending these hundreds of millions or billions of dollars to go through an enrichment process when you can buy it on the market.
So it would be cheaper for them to do this?
A lot cheaper. And particularly that's true for countries that have a few reactors and not a massive nuclear program. And that's the case in most instances.
Well, let's talk about the neighbors for a moment, because we've already seen this with India and Pakistan, for instance. If you are a country in a volatile neighborhood and the idea of this sounds attractive to you, but you're nervous about your neighbors maybe continuing on a path to perhaps developing a bomb, wouldn't you still be tempted to go ahead and develop your own?
This is not going to solve all the problems. It's one tool in the arsenal. And, of course, 60 years ago, the President of the United States, I believe Kennedy at that stage, thought there would be 30, 40 countries with nuclear weapons by now. Instead, there are about 9 countries. Now, that's way too many. And I personally would like to see the world with no nuclear weapons, but we're a long way from that. And there would be a lot of very difficult steps that we've got to work toward anyway, whether we have that as a goal or not. But you take your point, Dennis. China developed nuclear weapons after Russia and the United States did. Then India felt, with our rivalry with China, they needed nuclear weapons, and they developed them. Then Pakistan was worried about India, and they developed them. And then, of course, Iran was worried about its neighbors, and fortunately that program has at least been halted for the next 10 or 15 years. We're pretty well assured of that with the Iranian agreement. But it's not perpetual, and so we may face that problem again. And, of course, North Korea is paranoid about South Korea, about Japan, about China, about the U.S., and they are developing their own. So the Non-Proliferation Treaty has worked fairly well, not perfectly, and there are a lot of loopholes in it. This is one of the loopholes where it gives people, every country has a right, at least they interpret it that way. Some people argue the other point, but a right to the technology for peaceful purposes. And because it's dual purpose, there's a real paradox here. And the challenge is where the gap is. And this is one tool to try to help fill that gap.
Now, this bank is still being set up, but can you give us an idea of maybe a region or several countries that you think might really be able to take advantage of this without staying nervous about their neighbors?
Well, I probably wouldn't. I shouldn't name the countries that may be thinking about a nuclear program, but the head of the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, said a couple of years ago there are 15 or 20 countries that are looking at the possibility of developing nuclear power. And the IAEA is charged with the responsibility of helping develop nuclear power and peaceful nuclear uses, but also helping safeguard to make sure those uses aren't converted. So this is a powerful tool for the IAEA in helping work with countries that may want civil power and saying, hey, folks, there's an alternative to enrichment. You may claim a right to enrich, but you don't have to enrich, and there are other ways to go about this.
So where does this fuel come from?
It'll be purchased on the open marketplace. There is a market for low-enriched uranium and for converting that low-enriched uranium to actual fuel. Different types of fuel are converted from low-enriched uranium. So there is a marketplace out there, and it generally works. I was present when Director Amano was asked a question a year or two ago about if this was never used, would it be a waste of money? He said it's already being used. It's not even been developed yet, but we already are talking about it with countries that aspire to civil nuclear power, and we're encouraging them to utilize the marketplace and to utilize this backup bank. So this concept has been around a long time, and what NTI, our organization, did, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, I talked a good bit to Warren Buffett about this and then made a phone call to him from a bench right outside of a hotel in Vienna before I was about to call on Director L. Baraday back in 2006. And on the telephone, we had never discussed the amount before, but Warren said to me, what amount is needed? And I said, $50 million. He said, can we make it a 2-to-1 match so the world matches it 2-to-1 and we have $150 million total? I said, that's a great idea. And then I remember the closing line I had in the telephone call. I said, Warren, thanks a million. And then I said, that's not enough. Thank you 50 times that. So it was a very unusual way this went about, and only Warren Buffett would have made that kind of a commitment, oral commitment, but totally credible, and he's followed through. And the other countries in the world, including Norway, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, the EU, European Union, and America, as well as Kazakhstan, have all put in the money. The money's been raised now. China and Russia have given transit rights because you've got to be able to take the fuel and put it on trains and move it across countries when a country calls on the bank. And so it's been an international effort, and it shows what can happen when countries work together. And this is an unusual kind of circumstance when countries come together like this, but it's got to be the pattern of the future because the threats we face, not just nuclear, global warming and others, are all going to have to be addressed by cooperation between nations.
I know you asked him for help, but were you surprised that Warren Buffett sank $50 million into this?
Warren doesn't surprise me anymore. I was on the Coca-Cola board with him for a number of years. He's a unique individual. For a long time, he had the theory that he could make money and let the next generation disperse it through foundations. He always had that charitable instinct, but he didn't think he was the one to make those charitable decisions, but he switched, and we were one of his earliest supporters. So he's unique in the very best sense of the word.
You mentioned that nuclear power is on the wane here in the U.S., except here in Georgia, where we're continuing to build the two new Vogtle nuclear reactors, at least for now. If the idea of reducing our dependence on nuclear energy continues in the industrialized countries, could you rely on that source for the developing countries that might still use it or might still need it?
Well, right now, nuclear is having a rough time, both because of the aftermath of Fukushima and all the changes that came about after that, and they found out new safety, and you've always got to put safety and security first on nuclear power. But the other thing is natural gas. That's the big thing. Natural gas has come along. The price has been very cheap. Fracking has really been a breakthrough. It's changed the whole international market, and it's made nuclear power in this country less competitive. I still think there's an important role for nuclear power. The sun is going to be a big source of energy. I'm all for solar. Wind is a big source, and I'm all for wind. And so we do need to move away from carbon-based fuels, but you got to have a base load. The sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, and I think nuclear is still going to be relied on, if not in the next few years over the long term in this country, but more importantly, all over the world.
Would a country have to pay back what it takes from the bank?
It'll be marketplace, market price. So if a country,
it pays money just to
absolutely,
do it.
The money will go to the IAEA, and then they will repurchase on the marketplace. It'll be countries that are cut off one way or the other politically, because they're just a few suppliers these days, and countries do legitimately, some of them legitimately, fear that they will be cut off if they're not friends of the big powers that make the enrichment process. So they do have that fear, but some countries, as we've seen, also use it as an excuse, and we're trying to take away the excuse and the fear.
Why store all this in Kazakhstan, and is there enough of a security assurance to make sure that the stockpile stays where it is and stays under the control of the International Atomic Energy Agency?
This is a very good question, Dennis, and it's been checked out very carefully. First of all, Kazakhstan gave up their nuclear weapons. They were a country that had the perhaps third or fourth largest arsenal in the world when the Soviet Union broke up. They gave up every one of those weapons. Nazarbayev, the president of Kazakhstan, has been a leader in the nonproliferation. They also, and my organization, worked with them to get rid of their highly enriched uranium. They got rid of not only the weapons, but also the material that could make the weapons. So they've been a real leader in this regard. They also have the one of the largest uranium supplies in the world. So if they wanted to have their own, they could have it again. They know how to do it. So it's not any threat from that point of view. And I think it's also, being a Muslim country, I think it sends a very powerful signal. And it's also important that the UAE and Kuwait both put in, I believe, about $10 billion each, because they also are Muslim countries. And I think this is kind of an example we, I think, should build on.
Have you gotten buy-in on this from the Trump administration?
I think the Secretary of Energy, Perry, I believe he has made favorable comments about it. I haven't talked to him personally about it, but my partner, CEO now, Ernie Moniz of the Threat
Former
Initiative.
Energy Secretary in the
right.
Obama administration.
That's right. Ernie has talked to Secretary Perry several times, so I know they are fully aware of it. And we've had support from Democratic and Republican administrations. In fact, the George W. Bush administration was the one that put up the $50 million to match Buffett. Actually, $49 million. Buffett's still the biggest contributor. But that U.S. Donation was a I think a wise investment. It came under Republican administration. So it's been supported on both sides of the aisle.
When will it be ready to actually go into operation? And will you go to countries then with, I guess to put it bluntly, a sales pitch?
I think the sales pitch will mainly be the IAEA, because most countries really do seek their help. IAEA has a whole host of experts in every facet of civil nuclear power, and they also run the safeguards regime to prevent countries from having a diversion of supply to go into a weapon program and take it up to a high-level enrichment. So I think most of the marketing will come through that process.
With more countries having access to the bank, will the monitoring job be tougher to make sure they don't go from low-enriched to bomb-grade?
It will be probably tougher as the civil nuclear power grows, but not nearly as tough as they started if they started enriching. That's the horror. Enrichment proliferation is just as dangerous as and leads to, actually, they connect with weapon proliferation.
So if somebody were to say giving more countries access to emergency supplies that they might not otherwise have had, that will still reduce the risk of proliferation?
Oh, absolutely, because they can buy it on the marketplace. It's out there now. It's not a commodity that is in scarce supply. In fact, right now, the price is pretty cheap. It's a good time for the bank to buy the uranium. And you ask the question, when will they actually put uranium, low-enriched uranium? And the answer is they'll start early next year. They had to do all the checking about earthquake. You know, the site's got to be built. The building has now been built. So what we're doing next Tuesday in Astana, Kazakhstan, is dedicating the building and the facilities. So it's a big deal for Kazakhstan. It's a big deal for the IAEA, and though it's not something many people in the world know about, it's very important for the future of nuclear power as well as security.
A couple of minutes left to talk about something very complicated and quite urgent, North Korea. The U.S. hit 10 companies from China and Russia with sanctions because it says they do business with North Korea in ways that would advance that country's growing nuclear capability. China immediately responded, very unhappy about that. Was this the right move for the U.S.?
I don't know the details of this particular set of sanctions and what those companies allegedly have done. But the bottom line is we've got to help enforce the U.N. resolutions. Those resolutions have been passed by the U.N. Security Council, voted favorably. China voted favorably. Russia voted favorably. So
that's
everybody.
One of the reasons China was upset was they said, look, we're abiding by those resolutions, and so now the U.S. is coming in with these sanctions on our companies.
Well, I think we've got to have quiet discussions with China if we want to solve the North Korea nuclear problem without a war. And I think that's what everyone should want to do if we can do it without a war. God forbid the South Koreans would get smashed in a war. North Korea would lose, and they'd lose decisively, and it wouldn't take long. But in the period it took, South Korea, the capital city, is only 30 miles from the border. And even without the nuclear threat, there are enough artillery tubes right there underground in the mountains around near Seoul within 30 miles to destroy South Korea. So I think trying to get rid of the nuclear weapons in North Korea is the right goal. Trying to do it without a war is the right goal. We must have quiet understandings with China. I'm assuming some of that discussion is going on. I hope these sanctions don't interrupt that, because this is absolutely crucial. We've got to not only talk to China about what we want them to do, which is enforce these resolutions, UN resolutions. We've got to see what's on their mind, because they worry about their border. They worry about refugees. They worry about the collapse of the regime. They worry about American troops on the border. They worry about the large exercises we have with South Korea. All of those things have got to be discussed quietly with the Chinese. And so I'm hoping that while we enforce the UN resolution with sanctions, we do it in a way that does not cut off meaningful communication with China, and that communication has got to be greatly increased.
You've said before in conversations with me that it's time to talk directly with North Korea itself. Given their actions in recent months, is that something you still think should
happen? Yes. I think the rhetoric has gotten out of hand. I think sometimes the fear of preemption and the rhetoric can cause preemption, and it can cause a mistake where neither country wants a war. And, of course, that has calmed down a bit. I hope it will continue to be calmer. I do think we ought to talk directly with North Korea, and I think we shouldn't have a lot of conditions, but it shouldn't be a negotiation. It should be a discussion about how we get to negotiation, because the negotiation has got to include South Korea, it's got to include Japan, it's got to include China, and also Russia. So the six-party talks are the goal. It's going to take time. We're not going to see the North Koreans get rid of their nuclear weapons overnight. Hopefully we could find a way to negotiate a freeze. We're going to have to discuss with the North Koreans the peace treaty. They are almost paranoid about the fact we still are technically at war with an armistice. We've never had a peace treaty. They think that the sanctions are wrecking their own economy. In my view, it's their own rotten system. But nevertheless, we've got to put some things on the table, sticks, but also carrots.
Did the president's fire and fury comment specifically make things worse? Not really in the long run have much effect on North Korea's development at all? Or did it perhaps give them pause? I mean, there are three schools of thought on this.
Well, I suspect, North Koreans are already paranoid and xenophobic, so I'm not sure it added very much to that paranoia. But also the thing you've got to watch in that kind of rhetoric is commanders out there in the field making a terrible mistake, given the environment and the atmosphere and the fact they fear that we're about to go to war. If you've ever been to the demilitarized zone between the North and South, you know how dangerous that is every day of some type of unintended attack or an accident. But the other thing we have to really watch is South Korea's an ally, and Japan's an ally. And while we are warning the North Korea properly about what would happen with their actions, I don't think we should be using the term what we're going to do by their threats, because they threaten some actions every day. The question is actions, as Secretary Mattis made clear. While we're doing that, we've got to be careful we don't frighten the South Koreans and put the alliance in danger, because if we start seeing a huge amount of political dissent in South Korea, fearing the Americans are going to launch an attack, then you could have the alliance begin to slip apart, and that would be in itself an additional danger. The North could very well make misjudgments based on political dissent and appearance of splitting between the United States and South Korea.
Have you spoken to Secretary Mattis? And if you could speak to him or the president, what would you tell him?
Well, if they asked the questions you ask, I think I'd say exactly the same thing if I could remember it. I hope I can remember it.
Very quickly, we've got about a minute left here for, again, something very complicated. The president this week announced a strategy for Afghanistan. And one of the things he said was, we will not do nation building. But in order to be successful in fighting terrorism from a military point of view, don't you have to do some kind of nation building in the process? Are the two divisible?
Well, Secretary Rumsfeld said many years ago, in another context, we've got to measure whether we are killing as many terrorists as are now being grown as a result of the schools, as a result of the deplorable economic conditions, no hope, religious extremism, all of those things. And I think that's the real question. I don't think any of us want to get into nation building, but you better define the term, because economics make a difference. If a country has no hope economically, are they going to become a model democracy? No, not likely. Governance makes a difference. If the people of a country like Afghanistan believe their governments are corrupt, local, regional, and national, then there's very little hope that they're going to back them. And also, we have to understand that regional makes a difference. If we don't approach this situation regionally, which we have not been able to do, maybe we've attempted, maybe we haven't, but you've got to include the neighbors. America's not going to be there forever, and everybody in the neighborhood knows it.
Are you happy that the president said he would try to do that?
I think that's we'll see what he comes up with, but I think that's a step in the right direction. We've got to talk to Iran. We've got to talk to Russia. As distasteful as it may be, those countries have a real stake there economically, and neither one of them want total chaos. So we have a common denominator, a very slim one, but an important one, that is chaos in Afghanistan is not in the interest of any of the neighbors, including Pakistan. And, of course, Pakistan holds the access of our military forces. So we've got to emphasize the military, yes, but it's not going to work, and it hadn't worked for 16 years. It's not going to work unless we have diplomatic initiatives dealing with the Taliban. It's a local force. This is more akin to a civil war, unless we have a governance emphasis with getting rid of the corruption, and unless we have a regional kind of diplomatic approach. It's all those tools that got to be used. This military alone won't do it. We had 100,000 troops there at one point. Now we're talking about going from, what, 6 or 8 to 12 or 15, whatever the number is. You're not going to be able to accomplish long-range goals with just that number of troops.
But won't it depend on how you define victory?
Well, that's right, and I think that's very important. I don't think that we have ever done that under any administration. What is it we're really trying to seek there? We're really trying to convert Afghanistan into a Jeffersonian democracy? If so, I think we'll be there forever.
Former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn. Senator, thanks as always for giving us this time. We really appreciate it. Good to see you.
Thank you, Dennis. Enjoyed it, always.